Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. My guest today, Peter Greenback, with us. He's a computer consultant with Infostar.com, and he comes by every other month to help you with your tech-related problems. Today, we're going to talk about securing your home Wi-Fi, and we'll take your tech questions as well. I hope you can join in the conversation. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Peter Green, welcome back.
Always great, Larry.
So how easy is it for someone to kind of use your home Wi-Fi?
Well,
steal it, maybe.
It's not as easy as it used to be, but it's, you know, a lot of people don't change routers every year, every other year, every third year, every fourth year. Sometimes they leave things in place for a long time. And if you never change the default password, there's a website out there, and it's not just one, but there are several. Or you can go to the manufacturer's website and, you know, look up what the default router password is for that particular model. So that's doing your own homework, you know, if you lost it. There are IP addresses that kind of give it away, 192.168.0.1.0.10.1.1. You know, some of the manufacturers are stuck on that's what they use all the time when they put it out there. So, and we've talked about this even, in fact, on the last show, we talked about the main company and their one of their flagship products called speedtest.net. And I've talked about using it over the years, you know, when you're out there to test your internet connection. Well, yeah. Typically you use it on a smartphone, an iPad, a laptop, you know, when you're traveling, when you're using Wi-Fi in a hotel room. Well, the same thing goes when you're driving around. It's going to show you, you know, what Wi-Fis are available. And if they're not secure, you can connect to them. So that would be like being in a coffee shop. If they didn't give you, you know, it said free Wi-Fi and it was unsecure, you don't need to give a password. You just get on it. But let's say you're driving around. They call that war driving. We talked about this probably 10, 15.
Yeah, war driving.
Yeah. Yeah, that's just the name they give to it.
They have walk driving and bike riding, right? Bike driving.
Yeah.
Oh, so, these names.
Yeah. So basically, you could potentially, the term is piggyback, you know, onto using somebody else's internet. And I've done that before. And you basically do that legally when you're in an airport and they say, hey, you know, you can log in for free. But if you're driving around, you know, and a Wi-Fi comes up, you could take a stab at, you know, putting in default passwords. And some of the default passwords are, you know, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Yeah.
All zeros, you know.
Yeah.
You know, you could just sit there and try it. Keep trying it. Keep trying it. And like, bingo, you know, I'm in. So if you haven't changed a default password and you're using an older router, it would be a good idea to change it to something that you know. And use passwords that use a combination of upper and lower case, maybe misspell a word or add something onto a word. You know, like I've used, you know, like Go Vikings or, you know, Go Cubbies, not Go Cubs, and, you know, add numbers and special characters or symbols to it, you know, things like that. But don't leave it, you know, the default password. Now, people have had passwords set up in their homes for, you know, Charter, AT&T, UVerse, and so forth. So those routers that are set up, usually are done by somebody else and they say, hey, here's your password. And it's this really crazy set of numbers, letters, and characters that mean absolutely nothing to you. So, you know, you're going to have to keep that one in a safe place. It will work, but make sure you keep that in a safe place. Otherwise, you're going to have to, you know, completely reset your router in order to get into it and change it again. So I recommend to go in and at least make something that's familiar to yourself rather than, you know, some crazy combination of letters, characters that mean absolutely nothing to you.
Well, there is software out there. You can buy it online, for goodness sakes, to break into people's Wi-Fi.
Yeah, there are programs out there that will sit there and, you know, keep trying until, you know, they figure it out. It may take a long time. Depends on how important it is to the hacker. And as you can tell, you know, the hacker business is very lucrative. What's unfortunate is you see today with the scamming and phishing going on, not just on your PC or your laptop, but also on your smartphone, where they, you know, text message you and say, hey, you know, go here, or they call you and say, hey, I'm from Apple, but they're not from Apple, or they say they're from Microsoft, but they're not really from Microsoft, and they try to get you to interact and do things like that. So, you know, the hacking business is very lucrative because all it takes is to find that one golden egg, you know, somebody not really thinking and giving up a lot of information to somebody that they shouldn't be.
Yeah, I can think of one that keeps coming back to me. It happened, I got a call a few years back now from a woman who somebody got into her bank account, emptied the bank account, all of the savings account, and then she had like a $5,000, she could borrow $5,000 just on her doing it through the bank, and they also not only took everything, but then charged up $5,000 on her account. She lost everything.
Yeah, so it's, you know, being smart about things, like you're not going to get a call from Apple saying your iCloud account has been compromised. You're not going to get a call from Microsoft saying that your tech support contract has expired, you know, things like that. And you're not going to get text messages from anybody that you need to interact with to give them any kind of information.
John in West Allis wants to know how to change his router password.
To change a router password, they usually give you instructions, and again, you could there's a website called routerpasswords.com that's available for anybody. So that's hackers and people that own their own routers. To go to the manufacturer's website, put in your model, and it'll tell you what the default password is. Now, if you don't know what the password is, if you're actively using it and you put in the password but forgot it, then you're going to need to reset it. So that's where you go back to factory settings or factory reset, and that's where it's a good idea to go to the website. And they might even have software for you to download and use, or they might have, you know, like a bingo sheet that says, here are the steps that you need to do to reset your password. But if you're using your router and you don't know your password, though, that's what you're going to have to do in order to, you know, change the password, because you don't know how to get in. But it's an admin, A-D-M-I-N, that's the person that's in charge, or the user. That's how they state it, is the admin, and then the password to get in.
You can't just call somebody and say, from the router company.
Well, if you call the router company, so a popular router company would be D-Link, Netgear, Cisco. You can call them up, and they'll say, you know, what's the router model number? And you'll tell them, and they say, well, here's, you know, I can email you the link on our website, or I can email you a PDF of instructions. But they're not going to be able to tell you what that password is unless it was the default password.
Yeah.
So you could try using the default password to see if you get in.
Yeah.
And if it works, then you can change it. But if it doesn't, then you're going to have to do a reset on the router. And typically it's like, you need to unbend a paper clip and stick it in a little hole, and you're actually pressing a very tiny button to reset the router.
And so can you reset the router without having to, and then just...
Well, the important thing is when you reset the router, if at all possible, but probably without being able to log in. There might be some things that you might have to get some tech help on making changes, because usually when you go into the setup of a router, there are certain things that you make modifications or changes to. Without knowing the password to get into that, you're not going to know what they are.
Yeah.
So I always recommend when you're setting up the router that you actually do a printout or print screens of what the router setup is in the event that you do have to do a reset, or if the router gets it breaks and gets changed out, that you know those changes that you need to make. So, for example, at work, if it's a business router, sometimes you have the assignment of workstations or IP addresses begin at a certain number, and that may not be 0 or 1. It may be 100 and above. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you need to go in and make those kind of changes.
Jane in Eau Claire has a question. Hi, Jane.
Yes. You know, you made the comment about a lady having her bank account emptied, and I'm wondering if you or the guests know how they do that, whether it's through wire transfers once they get into the account, whether they actually have checks produced. I don't think they show up in person and make withdrawals. And I'm just wondering how the bank doesn't catch fraudulent transactions, and maybe that's a different show. But if you know, well, I'd like to know.
If they have access to the bank account, they can transfer money. So it can be and trust me, these hackers are smart. So they might have bank accounts set up for the UW Credit Union, Associated Bank, M&I, you know, the list goes on and on. So they might have actual accounts set up for each one of those. So it's a could be a simple transfer. It doesn't even have to be a wire transfer. So that's one way for them to do that.
And the thing is, once they have your number, you know, for your account, they can get in and they can do what they want. And you're really out of luck. Mm-hmm. If they get your money, you know, there's no it's all the more reason to have additional safeguards when it just comes to the bank. We're not going to stay a lot on the bank, mm-hmm. but you have two-factor authentication is probably the most, in my mind.
Yeah, I was going to say, critical. You know, it gets also back to the use of things like, you know, smart password protection on your accounts, not using the same password among multiple accounts. Some banks, some financial institutions actually require you to change your password every so often and not use the most recent passwords that you've used for like the last 3 or 6 times, to keep you honest in making sure that you're changing it. And then also the double authentication that you talked about, where you have another device, typically a cell phone, so that when you make any kind of change on the account. So, for example, whenever I go to add a payable in my UW Credit Union account, It always asks me for the code that it texted me on my cell phone. Yeah. Without doing that, that's not going to get validated. It's not going to happen.
Yeah, it's
so those kind of steps are important to ensure, you know, that it's secure.
Yeah, there you go, Jane. Thank you so much. Lindsay emailed that she has 2 young children. She has several steps in place to keep them safe online. They have timeout limits on their devices, Windows profiles, along with limited account access to things like YouTube, Amazon, etc. Another step they've taken is not to have a smart home, I should say. So no Alexa, smart light bulbs, thermostats, doorbell, etc. Any other suggestions for programs or apps she could use in addition to help keep her kids safe? And Lindsay sounds like she's doing a lot of good things there to keep her kids safe.
I don't know any specific programs, but I know they do exist where they allow you to essentially monitor what the user is doing. So it's without their knowledge. So you can go back and explore places they've visited if they've installed software that you don't see or recognize. You could probably find, you know, doing some Google searches for, you know, safe internet use for children. But it sounds like she's doing a lot of good things.
Yeah, I'm sure
she has parental control on her TV and things like that as well. And also making sure that they don't have access to the passwords that can change, the setups. That's the other important thing.
Yeah. Peter Green of InfoStar.com, our guest today. Questions for him, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller, Jill Nadeau, our producer today, Nigel O'Shea, our engineer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. The candidates for the Democratic presidential nomination face each other for their next debate, the Democratic presidential nomination. That's tomorrow night at 7, so I hope you'll join us for live coverage and analysis from NPR Tuesday night at 7 here on the Ideas Network and online at WPR.org. Taking a look at computer issues today, some tech issues with Peter Green of InfoStar.com. Great to have him come by. Questions for him, I hope you'll join in. We've been talking a bit about security here and, you know, how to sort of make your home Wi-Fi as safe as it can be and other questions of that nature. We can take other questions as well at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@WPR.org. So join in with your questions and comments. Any other internet security kinds of things that we ought to?
Yeah, so, a lot of businesses conduct, transactions. They collect data. They process credit cards. They communicate with email with customers and so forth. And a lot of people using mobile apps and things like that. So a website that does business that way is required, well, should be required, should have an SSL certificate, Secure Sockets Layer certificate, that basically keeps that data and payments safe, encrypted during the transaction. So you should always look for an SSL, and we've talked about that solid lock versus a broken lock. The other thing is the credit card processing. The website that does that is required to be PCI compliant, which is a payment card industry data standard, so that when the transaction takes place, you know, what are they doing with the data? How are they handling the credit card information? And that is tested over and over and over again. And MasterCard, Discover, Visa, they actually require that of websites to do that testing on a regular basis, so that, you know, our stuff is secure. What's interesting are a lot of the data breaches occur on very large websites like, you know, major retailers or even the credit card companies themselves like MasterCard or Visa card, because somebody's actually hacked into the larger system and not just the smaller websites that are constantly being vigil to protect, you know, their customer. It's the bigger sites that seem to get compromised all the time.
Yeah, I've been lucky on a couple of occasions. Somebody's gotten my number, my credit card number, probably when I paid something for mm-hmm. something and had to give it. And the credit card company has called me and mm-hmm. said, were you going to really send some jewelry to Arizona? And I said, no. And they said, oh, okay, well, we'll get rid of that charge for you.
Sometimes they won't even let the charges go through because they're monitoring that.
Yeah.
And I've actually had calls where they said, we have a transaction from North Carolina, and here I am in Madison, And I'm like, no, that's not me. And they're like, okay, you're going to have to stop by our a local branch and get a new card because we just shut your account down.
Yeah.
You know, for,
yeah.
So sometimes they don't even let it go through.
Yeah, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Well, Susan in Grandview, it's your turn. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So many years ago, I bought a Kodak camera.
Okay.
And I downloaded all the applications onto my computer so that when I put my pictures into the computer, I can play with them and edit them and change the filters and, you know, make them different.
Yeah.
And a few years ago, I threw all that stuff out of my computer by accident. And Kodak has gone out of business. And I emailed them, but all I got was, we're out of business now. Is there any site that can help me to to put that Kodak information back onto my computer?
So when you say Kodak information, because you're talking about, you have the pictures, right?
I have my pictures, okay. And I can load them onto the computer, but I can't edit them and fix them and change.
Oh, there's lots of software out there to edit and fix pictures. There's free programs. Google has Picasso on their list of apps that you could do a lot of work with. Photoshop is one that's very popular from Adobe. In fact, you can download a free trial and use it for 30 days from Adobe's website and see if it. I mean, the Photoshop software does a lot of professional work that people do, for editing pictures.
And I don't see why it wouldn't work for the Kodak photos.
Yeah, I don't see why it wouldn't either.
Well, thank you. I will continue to use them. I just don't know how to get my Kodak.
Well, the thing
it just doesn't exist anymore.
I mean, if you really wanted to, I don't know how old the Kodak software that you're looking for is. Is it for a Windows machine?
Yes.
Okay, you could probably try and search and see. There might be some sites that might have it available for download. The caution there would be to make sure they're reputable sites and they're not tagging along a malware or something along with them.
I'd be a little concerned.
So that's where I would have my concerns. Like Larry says, I would definitely second that part. But like I said, there are a lot of excellent free programs out there as well as, retail, programs that you can buy that do a lot more than you can imagine. Yeah. Especially, let's say if the Kodak software is like 5 years ago, and now 5 years have passed, there have been, changes made in that software that were shut off 5 years ago that now you would have available to use.
So there you go, Susan. Thank you so much for calling.
And there are tutorials out there, too. Go to YouTube.
Oh, yeah. Go watch them.
Lots of tutorials out there for you.
Gregory in Turtle Lake, it's your turn.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. A couple of years ago, I bought an Alexa, and I couldn't get it to hook up, and so it gave me a number to call, and so I called the number, and it was some kind of a service, and they were going to charged me, I think, $100 to get my Alexa working and hooked up to the computer and everything, and so that worked, and so then they asked me if I needed an antivirus, and I said, yeah, I guess I could use one. And what they have is, I think it's for a lifetime service. They charge like $200, and they'll tweak your computer once a month, you call in. But what you have to do is turn your computer over to them. And so far, they've been very good. I mean, I've had them for, like I said, 2 or 3 years now, and I haven't had a problem, and they've actually fixed a couple things. Is this a good thing to do, though, turning the computer over to somebody like that?
I've personally never heard of them. Having someone remotely access my system, I do that at work in a controlled environment for a specific task. Yours is, you know, to review security on your system. I would personally, I'd feel a little uncomfortable having somebody remotely access my system to review my security. I would make sure that you're not saving your passwords on your system, that whenever you access a password, you know, a site that requires a password, that you're not saving it to your system. I would do some more due diligence on the company just to make sure. I personally have never heard of them.
So, yeah, and I've been working for 2 or 3 years, but...
Yeah, it sounds pretty safe, but if, you know, they get compromised, you don't know if you're getting a call from somebody that, oh, I know how to remotely access his system, I can now get in there and peek around.
That's the danger right
there.
Yeah,
so... you know, like I said, at work, I have that happen where I have remotely access the system, but it's in a very controlled environment. It's usually observed to see what the results are, and they generally do not access anything else on that system. So
there you go, Greg. Thank you very
much.
And
I shut it down after they're done.
Yeah. Well, for sure. Mm-hmm. Jim and Avoca, your turn.
Hey. Glad to hear you, Larry.
Thanks for calling.
We live out in rural Wisconsin in Boca, up in the hills. We live in a forest. I use satellite for our television and our internet. And as of September 30th, I've lost my email. And I've called HughesNet every day for the past 2 weeks, and they basically won't say anything. I've Googled the error I keep getting, which is HTTP error number 403, and I find a variety of posts online, from whole websites going down to email to whatever it may be. And I'm just kind of at a stump. I don't know what to do. I really, without my email, I can't do anything online, really. And I was hoping Peter might have a suggestion on what we may do next.
Okay. Well, Jim, I actually have the same thing at home like you do. I have DirecTV and Usenet for TV and for internet access. I recently changed to their Gen 5 system, so they sent me a new router, and I put that in place and changed the password on it. One thing I forgot to mention is some of the newer routers do have passwords printed on the back of them, and they are kind of terms or weird words, mm-hmm. but they are changing default passwords on some of the newer ones. As far as what's going on with your email, number one, you could probably try to who are you using for email? You know, what are you using Usenet setup? Or are you using?
Yes, I go through Usenet.
Do you use Gmail? Do you have a Gmail account?
My wife does. I do not.
Okay, so she can access Gmail, correct? Because that's web based.
She said only Willow and Junk is coming through.
Hmm. That is weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, she uses hers as an artist through her artwork and whatnot, so I really don't get into it. But I have the new system with Usenet, and their password is printed on the back of the router.
Right, yep.
So
that's why I mentioned that, because a lot of the newer ones are doing that to make it a little bit easier to find the default password, and it is not zeros or 123456. So, okay, so you've got the new Gen 5. So your Usenet email, do you have web accessibility of the email? In other words, can you log into a website in the cloud and look at that email?
No, I don't know. I mean, I have... You know, I go online every morning and read all my papers.
Uh-huh.
I can get online to do all sorts of things, except no email.
So what do you use to look at your email? Do you use Outlook? Do you use...
Safari.
Well, Safari is web-based. That's not email. So are you going to a specific web page? You must be going to...
No, when I turn on my computer, it goes right to HughesNet's
website.
Email page.
Which is, so right. When you go to that page, are you saying it's not there and you can't log in?
Yes, It's nothing. It just shows me a error number 403.
Yeah, that's a missing page.
Right.
Yeah. So
it says the account cannot be accessed at this time, powered by Jetty.
And so HughesNet, you've contacted HughesNet, and you've talked to them, and they've told you they can't do anything?
Basically, yes, Larry. I've called them every day for over a week, and it gets to the point where I'm on for over an hour, and then they just disconnect me. It's just so frustrating.
Ugh.
See, logically, that doesn't make sense because that means that their whole email system is down. If they're pointing you to the web page, have you tried clearing the history on your browser?
Yes, yes. That's the last time I talked to HughesNet, which would have been Friday. We were on for over an hour, and I deleted all my cookies. I went through history, cleared my history, and then they were going to change my password. We did all of that, and then nothing happened, and then they just disconnected after 57 minutes.
Yeah, you're going to have to keep trying.
That's the only way.
Yeah, because all the questions I asked you were trying to lead to, okay, what email client are you using to read your email, to receive and read your email? And when you said Safari, that means that it's web-based because you're looking at a web page. And the 403 error means that that page is not there. So it's something to do on their end that's not letting you see that web page. There's a problem on their end. If you've cleared all the history and have you tried with a different browser other than Safari? You should try seeing if you download Google Chrome and go to the same web page and see if that problem, if it still persists.
That's a good idea.
If you go to Google Chrome and you're able to gain access to it, then it means there's a problem with Safari. So I guess that would be the next thing I would do is I always recommend that you use at least more than one web browser to see if you're having problems with the same site. Because if it's the same problem with two different web browsers, then it means that there's a problem with the website. If there's a problem with just one web browser, that means there's a problem with the actual browser that you can't get through with, which in this case would be Safari. If Chrome works.
Definitely the next step.
Yeah. Yep, the other one would be Firefox or Mozilla that you could download as well.
Yep. So give that a shot, Jim. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Colin emailed to ask if he has a secured Wi-Fi network and installs some wireless nanny cams. Are those cameras considered secured, or are they a weak point that needs to be reinforced somehow, and how would you do that?
No, the nanny cams are actually okay because if you actually are hooking them up to a secure Wi-Fi, that's how you're getting them to function. So you wouldn't be able to actually look at them unless they were secure. So when you go through the setup of them, that's what's maintaining security.
You're right. I don't see that being a problem. Mm-hmm. We have Susie emailing and asking for ways to organize, remember, and systematically create and use passwords. She says it's overwhelming to remember all the passwords, and some sites require frequent changing, or you can't use the same one repeatedly. And I know it is really
well. There's a good answer. Yeah, there's a good answer for her. And it has become quite popular over the years. I know I did a quick look up, and there's three of them that are password managers: Dashlane, LastPass, and Keeper. And they range from free to the premium versions of like $5 a month for their services, and some of them. Can you change one password and it's changed, you know, across the whole board for every, you know, website that you use a password for? The good thing is they make your life easy by, you know, you remember one master password to get into their system, and then you tweak it for all the sites that you go to, and all you have to do is just log into that one password manager, and you can gain access to everything that you need. So there are people out there that use this on a regular basis and love it. I personally don't, but for some people, it's a godsend. You know, yeah. It works great. You can look for reviews out online and see what other people think of the different ones that are out there.
And what were the three again?
Dashlane, LastPass, and Keeper.
There are a lot of,
and you'll find others out there, a lot of them.
Sandy in Woodstock, your turn. Hi, Sandy.
Yeah, hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got three mobile phones trying to avoid a hacker that lives in my building. And he's locked me out of Google, Gmail. I can't download another browser. It's amazing to me what they can do and how they can get apps on the dark web. But this guy is relentless. I called the police on him one time, and he hasn't stopped since then. If I go from one room to another or I change my passwords on my phone, he knows them almost immediately. How does he do this?
He might have installed software on your system that tracks, you know, a keyboard logger, tracks use on your system, and it emails him. I mean, that's if you didn't know that he had gotten into your system early on, I mean, that's a possibility.
Because I've shut off the Wi-Fi and the Bluetooth and everything, mm-hmm. but when I go into the controls, I turn on Wi-Fi and then I turn it right off, and it goes back on and then goes right off. So I think he's coming in through Wi-Fi or Bluetooth because the same thing happened. But then he blocks it so that I can't see that it's on.
I mean, you can make technical changes where you can, you know, you have to go through the expense of putting in another router with, you know, where you have full control over it. You'd have to redo the operating system on your computer to eliminate, you know, whatever has been put on there to compromise it. The other option is to just move away from the person.
Yeah, but you could really.
Yeah, you could put in another router where you know you have absolute control of, and he won't be able to get into it. And then the other thing is you would have to redo your computer as well to eliminate anything that's, you know,
yeah, because
been compromised
on it. If your computer's already compromised, he could get into the new router.
Yeah.
So the first step would be to, how would she go, what would she do first? She'd get the new router?
No, do the computer over first.
Yeah. And to do
disconnected. We've talked about this for a long time. The only way you can guarantee that no one can get into your system is to be unhooked from the internet 100%. You can go to any seminar, look at any white paper that talks about internet security, and they will tell you the only way to guarantee that you will not get hacked or infiltrated or compromised is not to be connected. So fix the computer.
And what do you do to fix the computer?
You would get your data off, and your data, you'd probably, you know, have that scanned to make sure that there's nothing attached to it, no viruses or, you know, hidden programs. So you get your data off, and then you would completely reinstall the operating system on the computer, reinstall the apps that you need, reinstall your data and make sure it works, all this being unhooked to the internet. Then you would put a new router in place to hook up
and
to
hook
the internet.
That, and then hook it up to that router.
Right.
That
correct.
New router.
Hook up the computer to the new router.
All right.
Yep.
That makes sense. Sandy?
Same thing with a smartphone. If you suspect there are problems with your smartphone, I have not personally experienced or heard of that, but I would, you know, of all the things you see in movies and sci-fi, I can't say absolutely that it has not been compromised, especially if it's an Android phone, because that's an open operating, had been an open operating system. So that's a possibility as well. So then you would, again, back up your important data from your phones and then go to the store and have them factory reset it and then reinstall your data on the phones.
Yeah.
That would be the other thing to do as well.
So there you go, Sandy. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your
call.
Not
a nice neighbor.
No, not a nice neighbor for sure. Peter Green of InfoStar.com, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Join in with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your computer today with Peter Green of InfoStar.com, I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. Questions for him? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. Pauline emailed that she purchased, she has a HP Pavilion that she purchased 2 years ago. Problem is that the support assistant stopped working about 3 months ago. She researched the problem on the HP website, uninstalled the program, and reinstalled it, but it continues to stop working. Her warranty, of course, has expired. Just curious how critical the program is to the security of the PC. She checks daily for Windows 10 updates and runs Viper Advanced Security.
I wouldn't be too concerned about the support assistant from HP not working. It could be that they have issues with Windows updates that have been installed on her system recently. That's not unusual. And unless she really, had used it or is actively using it a lot, I wouldn't be too concerned. The Windows updates and regularly getting those, those in themselves cause issues. So I wouldn't be surprised if it actually was having a problem with a Windows update, and that's why it doesn't work. I've had so many problems with Windows updates where I've had to they make changes when they do an update to things that they shouldn't change, settings, options in your setup that interfere with having software run correctly. And we talk about it at work all the time, and it's like they have no business making some of the changes that they do, but they do. And then things stop working, and then you have to figure out why they stop working, and then you go look at it, and it's like, why did they change that? They shouldn't have changed it. So it might be a simple thing that, the Windows update made a change that's not allowing that software to work, and you just have to kind of play with it and see what will make it work, or go out there on the web and research and see if, how do I get my support assistant back?
But you don't need it.
No.
Yeah. William emailed to ask if he needs to buy antivirus software to protect his Apple computer from malware. Does Apple download protective software for Apple computers?
Apple's operating system is more secure than Windows, and that's been known for a very long time. It's not immune to being compromised. Malware Bytes is a popular one that's used for not just PCs, but also for Apple, and it's available for download. Apple does not provide, to the best of my knowledge, any particular. Their operating system is based on Unix. They revamped it and based it on Unix, which is a lot more secure than the Windows OS. And if you want a little extra measure of security and safety, having something like Malware Bytes is just fine.
Fine. Yep. Yeah. Let's take a call. Robin in Marathon, it's your turn. Hi, Robin.
Hi. Actually, I'm just looking for advice. I want to buy a laptop this year, but I'm not sure what to look for.
What do you need?
Are you looking for Windows, Mac, OS? Do you have a preference?
I'm more comfortable with Windows.
Okay. I would look, if speed is important to you, I'd probably, it depends on your budget, but if you had a budget that was in the range of, let's say, $500 to $1,000, something with an i7 Intel processor. AMD is, I'm not sure what their mobile processor for AMD is, but I'm sure they have something comparable to their desktop CPU is Ryzen class, which is very popular with gamers, and they're very fast. But aside from the CPU, I would recommend at a minimum of 16 gigs of RAM, and even consider if you can go higher than that.
Yeah.
The more memory, the better. In fact, all of the desktops that I use at work are 32, if they can be, and that depends on the system board. And memory costs have come down quite a bit. Adding an SSD drive has helps with speed as well as loading the operating system very quickly and the shutdown very quickly.
Is
and
that
the
what
software.
Somebody wonders right away? What's SSD?
So a solid state drive.
Okay.
And those you can start very small, but I would probably depending upon usage, probably at least a 512, I would look at a minimum. And they have different classes, and what you should look at is the read-write speeds. I would probably look at a minimum of 500 for read-write speed for an SSD drive. The faster, the better. Servers will have like 3,000 read-write megabits per second. So the faster, the higher the number, the better in terms of read-write speeds for the SSD drive. If you get a spinning drive, then 7,200 RPM would probably be the best one, you know, as far as high speed for spinning drives. The SSD drives are more durable. They don't have moving parts. The spinning drives are more mechanical, so they do have moving parts. Although they claim mean time between failure being, 10,000, 20,000 hours of use. Again, they have moving parts, so that number can vary greatly. if you can find a screen that does not have shared RAM, would be the best. But if it does have the memory, like I said, and the SSD drive and a good CPU, having shared memory is not going to really matter all that much.
All right. Does that help, Robin?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks very much for calling. You can join in, too, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Talk a little more about Catalina. You said you've...
Yeah, I decided to be brave last Thursday and downloaded it on one of the Macs that I use, and it went pretty smooth. It told me, it said, hey, I'm just giving you the heads up that some of these applications on your iMac are not going to work after I'm done. And I'm like, okay, let's go for it. So went ahead and did it, and I left it, came back the next morning, and it was all done. And sure enough, those applications had little circles with a line through them on the dock that said, yeah, not going to use me.
So what do you do?
So I removed them, and I downloaded the ones that I needed. I had a scanner that needed software update from Epson. Epson said, hey, I see that you're using 10.15? And I said, yep. Well, here's a new one. So I downloaded that, and that worked fine. Had new features to it that I had to get by, learning what changes it made. But once I figured that out, I was all good. And
the changes good? Or, I mean, what were the changes like?
It just changed the interface a little bit, but not different enough to, as far as usability. It seemed like it worked a little faster. I have 32 gigs of memory on it, and it seemed to work just fine. It sounds like a lot, but it really isn't. And machines are going to the next level. The next machines will have 64.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to that.
Christy is, in Washburn online. Hi, Christy.
Larry, thank you so much for taking my call. I have an iPad Pro. I recently downloaded iOS 13, whatever it is, and I probably hit something after that and lost all the open tabs that I have on my, I had them open for months. And I need to know how to get them back. Somebody suggested looking at my history. I know what that used to look like, and I can't find it. Even my all the pages look different.
So you're talking about the tabs on your on the Safari, the browser that you're running on your iPad.
Yes.
Yeah. You're going to have to probably you might want to do a Google search or maybe on YouTube to look for a video that shows, you know, points you in the right direction, how to see if you can get those back from your history. Because basically what you're saying is you had all these open web pages that were tabs that you really like to look at and go back and forth between, but because you upgraded your OS, they're all gone, which is pretty typical when they do that because they wipe things clean. So I don't know if your history is going to be there.
I don't. Yeah,
More than likely, it's not.
No, I'm with you on that one, unfortunately. Well, we can talk some more about that. Peter Green of InfoStar.com, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. We'll take a look at the news, then we'll be back with Pete. You stay with us. Taking a look at your computer today and technology relating to it with our guest, Peter Green of InfoStar.com. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in today. I really appreciate it. I think there's one open line at 800-642-1234. You can always email us at ideas@wpr.org. Pete, your new top 10 list is up, and we have a link on our website. So just go to WPR.org/Larry to take a look at all 10. But have you got a favorite there that you wanted to mention, Pete?
Well, I mentioned the one about the router passwords. That's up there. But also the one about securing wireless networks. There's a tip list up there that's a great resource.
Oh, cool. Very cool. And there's 8 more.
Yep, that's right.
Go to WPR.org/Larry, and there you'll find it.
I want to say one more thing about Catalina. So they delivered on the iTunes being split up. So that's on the dock after you launch Catalina. You get all those, the news, the TV, all that stuff is all organized just like they said they would.
Oh, cool. Yep. Well, you know, our caller just before the break had lost all her tabs, and you know, there may not be any hope for that.
What I do on tablets, I always like to do this on any system that I work on, and some people think I do it overboard. But learn how to take screenshots. So learn how to take screenshots on your phone, on your tablet, on your PC, on your laptop, and so forth. And if you want to, you don't have to write down, you know, all the elaborate information on your screen, but you've got a picture of it. So on like an Apple iPad, typically it's the power button and the home. You hit them in sync, and it snaps a picture, and then you've got a picture in your gallery to go back and look at.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And I do it on my Mac. I do it on PC all the time.
Somebody else wondered about... Well, before we get into that, I know Conrad in Waukesha has a question for you, so let's go there. Hi, Conrad.
Yes, hello?
Hello.
Yes, hello. Hello. I have a technical question that we were going over the last time we spoke. Still haven't figured out how to get a DVD, an internet movie onto a DVD, so I can play it at home. Hello?
Yep. Yeah. So you've downloaded a movie file, and you want to burn it onto a DVD so you can play it in a DVD player?
Yes.
Okay. There's software to do that. You probably just do, you know, a search online for that. I know with I remember with making my kids' movies, you had to download special software in order to play a DVD on a Windows machine after you created the movie. So in order to burn the DVD with that that movie file and put it in a format that the DVD player will understand, you need software to do that. There might even be some free programs out there to do that.
Yeah. There you go, Conrad. Thanks. Sharon in Beloit, your turn. Hi, Sharon.
Hi. Last week I logged on to my bank site.
Yeah.
And it had just opened, and then the screen went blue and said it was going to Microsoft because there was an error, and they're correcting it. So it downloaded something. I don't know what exactly, and then rebooted and came back. And I don't know. Does this sound kosher?
Do you have any kind of antivirus software on your system?
I have Windows Defender.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I would probably put something a little bit stronger on it, like Avast or AVG or Bitdefender.
Okay.
When it went to, you said it was being taken to another site or to Microsoft, did it look like Microsoft or did it look like a different or weird?
No, it didn't look weird. It's that blue background, you know, and it said something, Microsoft.com correcting something with the memory, you know, and I didn't really know how to get out of it, if there was a way to get out of it. And it started up, and it's been running okay, but I've never had anything like that happen. It didn't look weird, you know, like it was being hijacked or something, and it had, and I know that people can fake anything, you know, but I just wasn't sure if you had ever heard of anything like that.
No, I haven't heard of something like that, but it doesn't mean that it can't happen. I would probably go and download one of the antivirus programs and run a scan on your system, as well as with Bitdefender, and also make sure that that's updated. So you can, you know, when you're in Bitdefender, you could, in Microsoft Security, you could make sure that it is updated. That it ran it, that it's the most current version.
There you go, Sharon. Good luck. Thank you so much. Mary in Mount Horeb, we're on to you now. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I have an Apple question.
Okay.
I had an 2007 iMac, and a year or two ago I updated to a 17 iMac, and everything transferred over except the photos. And it said that it couldn't read them. I went to the Apple store, and they couldn't figure it out, which is a bad sign. and I was wondering if there's – I know there's a lot of, like, the little sole proprietorship companies that, you know, businesses that can, you know, kind of mess around with that stuff and fix odd things like this. I was wondering
We're losing your voice here, Mary. So
I know where she's going. Do you have those files transferred to like a thumb drive or an external hard drive?
Yes, I'm sorry. I don't know if you can hear me. It switched to my car.
Yeah.
Yes, I do. I backed it up just to be safe.
Mm-hmm.
And I do also have the photos on a Lacy hard drive.
Okay.
But I just can't get them to, because I would love to edit them and, you know, save what I want to save, but it won't let me transfer it to my new computer.
Yeah, you might, you know what you should do is probably see if you can get another computer to read them other than a Mac. Maybe try a Windows computer.
Okay.
And see if you can read those files. I've seen that work. It might be that there's something that's off and it has to be corrected. I'm sure there's software out there. I don't know where it is. You'd have to search for it to see if it can be to error correct on photo files and see if it can fill in the the missing information that it's looking for.
So what is it again? Error correct?
Error correcting for photo files.
Okay.
You're trying to correct it for a specific type of file. So if it's a JPEG or a TIFF file or an MP3 for music or MP4, you know, for video and so forth. So you're trying to error correct it for a specific purpose. And I'm going to assume that those are JPEG files. So it might be something that's very subtly off that the software can load that file and make the change to it and then save it so it is readable by, you know.
So go online and look and find error correct.
Error correcting software for photos.
Okay.
Yeah. And the other option I said is to try and see if you can load it with a different system, try it with a Windows.
Oh, yeah.
And see if that helps.
Well, that might be the simplest, yeah.
Sometimes that works.
Okay.
I've had issues where even on my phone, you know, you look at a file and you can't, it's there, but you can't see it. And you load it on the PC and you can see it. So it's existing time, it's holding time and space, but it's not being recognized. So you got to try and figure out if there's ways to make that work. And that's one of them.
There you go, Mary. Thank you for calling. Terry in Mass City, your turn now. Hi, Terry.
Hey, Larry and Peter. Always good to listen to you guys.
Hi.
I have a DVD player on my laptop. Is there software that will allow you to play DVDs from other regions, you know, the UK, things like that?
I know what you're talking about, because, you know, we're what, North America region in the code? you know, I've never explored that because I've never had a reason to, but there's probably a universal player out there that would read all of those formats. I don't see why there wouldn't be.
Yeah.
You just have to look for it.
I haven't
want to buy one, but I thought maybe there was software I could do something.
Well, if you go to a website like CNET, CNET.com, which has been around for, you know, 20 plus years, and they specialize in having a software site for downloads and reviews and things like that, they probably have an article on that, and they might even have you have links to suggested software and tell you what features there are.
Well, there you go. Thank you, Terry. You can join in, too. Open lines at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your computer question. We had someone else wonder about the difference between Apple and PC.
Apple and PC. Apple, when you say Apple and PC, well let's talk more about the Macintosh. That really came around in the early 80s with Lisa and then evolved into the Mac, which is using that graphical interface for the operating system. Windows roots started with the disk operating system, or MS-DOS or PC-DOS, and that evolved to eventually have Windows, which is a graphical user interface. But they differ in their approach. Similar, but yet different. And the Mac operating system has evolved to be from Unix, which is, I would consider, a more robust, more secure operating system. And when they give you updates, in general terms, they work and they work well. With Windows, they make a claim to be the most secure operating system in the world, but they aren't. And they're a little bit more buggy with updates and sometimes with how it operates over, you know, time where you need to reboot it because it's having issues. But again, both of them have the graphical user interface. Both of them have their own kinds of hardware. The Windows environment has a lot more open hardware. The Apple hardware is from Apple Computer Company only.
Yeah.
So that's probably the biggest difference is all of Apple hardware and software comes from not all the software, but, you know, the operating system. And when you hear the iTunes or the web, you know, Apple TV, all that comes from Apple. They have the control. And with Windows, it's a lot of variety, a lot of options, but it doesn't come from one company. It comes from many. So it's very open.
Very open.
Yes.
Which is why I like the Macs. John in Appleton, your turn. Hi, John.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you very much, gentlemen. See, I have a DVD that Google provided me of a deceased person's email account. It's 2 gigs of data in an inbox file. What do you recommend I use? Oh, and I have a Mac. I have a MacBook. So what software should I use to open an inbox file?
Have you tried doing any research on that at all?
Google provided some recommendations on something called Triumph. Mm-hmm. I did try the native Apple Mail application, and it spun for half an hour and came up with no messages, nothing.
So is it just one large file?
Pardon?
Is it just one large file that you're trying to read?
One large file, yeah.
Yeah.
I should look at CNET.
Yeah, I would probably do some research on that. I have imported messages, and usually it's, you know, I've used the importation process to pull it into an email system. The inbox format, you may have just certain options, you know, for doing that. And you're working on a Mac, so, I mean, that I would just look for those options, Mac software and inbox file, and see what comes up.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks, John. Cindy in New Berlin, your turn. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. My question is what to do with old computers. My family left. I've got 2 desktops, 2 MacBooks, and a Dell that are no longer being used.
Wow.
I want to make sure that they're purged totally because I'd like to see them donated for use, but if that's not possible, what's the best way to clean them out so you don't have to worry about someone getting your information?
Well, with the PC computers, you can use a utility which is called FDisk and just, you know, wipe out the partitions and do that a couple of times. And if you happen to have the operating system that came with it, it would be a factory reinstall. Some of the computers have built into them to do a factory reset, so you'd have to look at it individually. Sometimes they're built into the laptops, sometimes into the desktop computers, so you can actually do a factory reset and just wipe it clean. And then as far as the Mac, probably just, you know, deleting the data and then probably doing a reinstall of the operating system would be the best way to do that.
There you go, Cindy.
When you talk about reinstalling, is that a disk?
You'd need a disk or a thumb drive that would have the OS on it. So you would be able to mount that, you know, as a disk to use it.
Okay.
You have to do a little bit of homework on each computer to find out, you know, if you have the original disks. Sometimes they come with a disk that says, you know, factory reset or factory reinstall. The FDisk is a utility that you can use to download from probably like CNET would probably have the FDisk utility. It was built into earlier versions of Windows and DOS. I don't know if they still ship it with Windows. I'd have to look at that. But you're basically, you know, the computer has hard drives that are physical, and on those drives are partitions. And for some people that are listening that might say, oh, you know, my hard drive, the computer tells me I have a C drive, and I also have this other drive and it says sys or system on it, but I don't really know what it's for. That's the virtual drive that we're talking about removing with F-Disc. It would actually, physically, it's OneDrive C, but virtually it's got these other drives set up on it, and F-Disc is a utility that would, you know, erase or wipe them off.
Yep. There you go, Cindy. Thank you. And Brian in Green Bay, hello.
Hi there. I had a quick question regarding trying to get networking considerations for a new home build.
Okay.
I've spoken with the electrician, and I know that I'm going to be trying to be forward-thinking by using Cat 6A cable in order to implement a mesh network.
Sure.
But I would like to also consider, you know, maybe a rack-mounted NAS as well as a switch for that mesh network so that, you know, when we are in our family planning, we're looking at having kids. They've got all those LAN cables and the walls and the TV and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Could you recommend a specific maybe environment or companies that I could look into that would have quality components that would interact well with the systems that I'm looking into as well as IoT in the future?
One key thing is where you locate, you know, your switch where all those wires terminate is to try and minimize your runs. I don't know how big you're talking about for the structure, but to try and minimize your runs and also to, place access points for either amplifying your Wi-Fi signal or, you know, putting in place an access point. So, you know, just consider those things so that you have good coverage for your Wi-Fi. As far as a company that puts out products for that or make any recommendations, it really comes down to, you know, probably what things you're trying to accomplish, and then look and see, you know, what's out there and if there are any, you know, recommendations from, you know, some of the people who have written those articles, like PC Magazine, if you're looking at, you know, a dual band Wi-Fi router, you know, and what kind of, you know, how big of a space you're trying to cover and things like that. And that's why I mentioned minimizing your runs for where you're putting the switch, the main switch, which connects everything, and also having a good layout for where those access points are for amplifying your Wi-Fi signal. And then, you know, in terms of bringing in stuff to a home theater, you know, making sure that, you know, where you bring all those cables, where they're all located is going to be at the height that you need them to minimize, you know, the lengths, the runs, and,
yeah,
and, you know, just make sure they're put in place where you want them to be.
Yeah. And on that note, we are out of time. Peter, thanks so much for calling.
Always great, Larry.
For being thanks. With us today. We yep. will see you again. Thank you.
Yep.
Peter Green of Infostar.com, our guest today. Tomorrow we'll talk about our pets with holistic veterinarian Carrie Donahue, and then talk with the author of a new book called Our Dogs, Ourselves. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mehler.